I'm Julie Rose. Coming up this hour, the trend toward four-day school weeks. Does it save that much money? Do the students learn as much? Then how land managers like the BLM and Forest Service could do more after a wildfire to make sure that same area doesn't go up in flames. Also, timber theft is a big problem in the Pacific Northwest. We'll meet an investigator who tracks tree poachers. Coming up on Top of Mind, it's great to have you with us. School districts across America are strapped for cash. One solution that has been gaining popularity over the last decade is to shorten the school week. Do four slightly longer days in class, followed by a three-day weekend every weekend, which sounds awesome, if you ask me. More than 500 school districts in 25 states have gone that route, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. How's it working out? Paul Hill is founder of the Center on Reinventing Public Education. He's a professor at the University of Washington, Bothell, and he's on the line. Professor Hill, welcome.
Good afternoon.
What is the cost savings idea behind making this switch? Where do districts hope to save money by only doing 4 days of school?
Districts hope to save money by cutting down on staff salaries, for example, in the cafeteria, and bus drivers, and many of the districts that adopted the four-day first were rural districts that had long bus routes, and they thought they could save gas and maintenance and so on the buses. And it's particularly in northern areas, things like heat.
Right, because the idea, I guess it's kind of a strange trade-off because you're actually not shortening the amount of time students are in class, right? They're just in class for maybe like an hour and a half longer each day. So you still have to keep the lights on maybe later on the 4 days that you're in class, but you don't have to send your bus drivers out on that fourth, on that fifth day. So
that's right. And there are a few other possible savings, but as you said, there are some offsetting costs. For example, you know, you have the lights on longer. You may have to feed the kids a little bit in the afternoon just to keep them going. And, of course, the biggest single cost that a district pays, no matter what it is teachers. And the proposal has never been to cut teacher hours or teacher pay.
Right, because they're still in class. They're still doing prep. So it's not as though teachers are working fewer hours.
So the bottom line, the initial hope was that would save money, and that came at a time when districts were casting about to save money because the recession of 2008 really hit rural districts' budgets heavily all over the country.
Yeah.
And even though the budgets have been going up, their costs keep going up as teacher salaries cost more and so on. And the bottom line was that they tried to save money, but they really didn't. And the best outcome anybody ever got is around 2-3%, and that's, you know, in
2-3% of their overall budget they were able to shave off.
Right, in return for a 20% reduction in days, and the more typical is less than 1%.
Although if you're a big enough, I mean, that could still be $1 million if you're a big enough district.
It's a lot of money, but if you're a big district, there are a lot of ways to save $1 million. I mean, no matter what the scale is. You do have to ask the question of a 20% reduction of days. Does a 1% savings justify it when you could do things like close libraries earlier or do lots of other things?
Mm. Well, let's talk about what the trade-off is. What do you see as the downsides that you are getting in exchange for that 1-2% savings in your budget?
The downsides are all about instruction and kids. The ability to learn in the longer days, and then their ability to use the fifth day well. And before I start with that litany, I will say that there are plenty of examples of schools that were built to be four-day weeks or something like it.
Really? There are schools out there that always, from the very beginning, the whole idea was we're only going to be in class Tuesday through Friday or Monday
right,
through Thursday.
Right, or 2 or 4 days. And some of those are charter and some are private. And what they assume, however, is that they have a parent body that's going to enforce homework. They have teachers that are going to read homework and respond to it with comments. That have kids that can be really kept engaged on the fifth day.
Why do students have to stay engaged on the fifth day if they're already getting that class time spread out over those four other days?
Well, so nobody knows for sure whether the additional class time on a given day is beneficial. In fact, the evidence is pretty good that you learn more by learning something for a while and taking a break and going back to it than you do by persevering a long time. And that's also true that kids already are tired by the end of the conventional school day and add a couple, another hour and a half to that, it isn't clear how good their attention is, how isn't clear how much they learn. For that matter, it isn't clear how good the teachers are.
Nobody's looked at test scores or other outcomes? No one studied this?
There's been a little research on test score outcomes, and now there's some coming from RAND, but I haven't seen it, on things like persistence in school, dropping out, applying to college. There are two kinds of results on test scores. One, districts kind of casually look at their averages over time and say they don't change very much. So, that our test scores this year were about X and last year they were about X. So we say, well, we're not worried. But of course, everybody knows that different classes are different and you really have to track closely to know whether either an apparent rise or fall in just your average test score means anything. There was one study where in Montana that students were really tracked closely, and that showed that in the first year after the adoption of four-day week, kids did fine, but after that there was a substantial decline.
Hmm.
But there hasn't been any repeat of that study. And so the bottom line is that there's almost nothing known at the moment. One thing for sure is the results aren't catastrophic in the sense that kids, who were making the year's progress every year suddenly do half a year. That's not the case.
Okay.
But if there were subtle differences that might add up over time, we still wouldn't know it.
Wouldn't teachers have a pretty good sense, though, if there are, 500 school districts around the country that are doing this, and most of those districts are in just a couple of states, Colorado, Montana, Oklahoma, Oregon, you would think that teachers in those areas would, if there was a problem, they'd be raising the alarm and saying, this four-day thing is just not working for my kids.
I think that would be... that would be putting a lot of eggs in one basket to assume that teachers would be an adequate judge of that. For one thing, teachers, they're dealing with different kids every year, and if they have a tougher time with a new bunch of kids, they're not sure why. And secondly, even if teachers were asking the question seriously, they're kind of in a conflict of interest. If they're very much in favor of this change, they're not likely to see the downsides.
Do teachers usually like this change to a four-day school week?
We've interviewed a lot of teachers, and clearly, on average, it's popular. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why districts go to it, because even though they don't save money, they're able to hold on to their teachers who might go off to a city instead. But the other side of it is we hear teachers that are concerned about it, especially concerned about the little kids who may be too tired, and also students, especially in the West, Hispanics who have just settled out into the cities or into the towns, who don't have a lot of support, don't have a lot of help in the day off, and they're very concerned about those kids, kind of the most disadvantaged kids in the areas that are being where the 4-day week is being tried.
I know there's some debate over whether or not there's really any like knowledge loss during the summer when you're off for 3 months. Like, is being off for 3 days in a row every week? I mean, I certainly feel it when I come back from a three-day weekend. I kind of have to get my head back in gear for work. But do we have any sense that sort of constantly having to come back from a longer weekend would have any effect on the kids, ability to remember what they studied on Thursday before they took off, or, ability to sort of get back in school mode, those kinds of things?
We've heard some teachers who were critics of the four-day week say that to them it feels like the day after vacation every Monday.
Hmm.
And so there's a lot of inertia to be overcome. It may be, other teachers say that you learn how to overcome that, the kids get used to it, but I don't think the evidence is clear on that,
yeah.
And it certainly is a worry.
Professor Hill, I think it's intriguing, though, that teachers like this enough that in some cases it's a reason for them to stick with a rural school district,
right,
rather than transferring to an urban place where they might, be more interested in working. So if this is actually a selling point to get better teachers in the classroom, I guess that's another wrinkle here. Is it okay to take the risk, the potential risk on learning if we don't know for sure the outcome, but at least
right,
you're able to attract and retain quality teachers? If I'm a superintendent, that's pretty high on my priority list.
I agree. And we were pretty critical of the idea until we saw that consequence on the quality of the teacher force. And it may very well be that the 4-day week is going to grow for the reasons it's growing now, and that what the success of it long term will be determined by how well the teachers and the principals use the time in school and how well communities come together to support the kids on the day off. Mm. A lot of the outstanding examples in Colorado have been in places with a pretty rich nonprofit sector and churches and so on, and they've all stepped forward to help the kids that wouldn't normally have a mother at home to supervise them to have useful things to do in that day and to organize things like trips to the college campus or whatever.
Expand on that extra day off, because I guess that's true. If you're a working parent, you don't get to switch to a four-day work day just because your kids do necessarily. So what are parents in these districts doing on that fifth day?
Well, it's pretty clear that families that have a stay-home parent are much more positive about the four-day week than those that don't. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen this proposed in a big city or a place where there's a large number of working parents, how well that would be accepted. In rural areas, it looks like the parents who are the more prosperous and influential in the districts and the ones that the districts listen to are pretty happy about it. But no one knows about the more voiceless newcomers, say the immigrants and so on, and there's real concern that it isn't doing good for those families, and they haven't got a place to complain about it.
It could be convenient if you're a parent, if you're a stay-at-home parent. There's that one day. It could decrease absences for things like doctor's appointments. If you know that you've got a school day week where, a weekday where you can, put all of those doctor's appointments and whatever
right.
on that Friday or Monday.
Well, that's an argument for teachers as well, obviously, teaching is a demanding job, and particularly because you have to be there all the time. And if you've got a family, that makes it real tough. If you're in a rural area and you've got to drive 50 miles to a doctor, that limits the amount you could do for your children and maybe makes you take time off school regular
right.
times. So the claim has been that teachers are not absent as much. And I think that's just to be determined. That it makes sense they may try to be. One concern we have is that the teachers who were originally part of the deal, who said, let's go to a four-day week, let's make sure we don't have a decline in quality, let's be disciplined about our use of absences and so on, they are probably more likely to perform, to be responsible about things like their own absences than teachers that come in later. Hmm. We'll just have to see.
What are you seeing school districts actually do about that fifth day? If a school district feels like we need to, cutting the transportation costs is a big thing for us because we're in a rural area and
right.
keeping our teachers happy is important to us. But also we do know that there are some families that can't afford an extra day of daycare. We know that maybe there are some kids who rely on that school breakfast and lunch for food. Are school districts able to somehow provide services without erasing all of the savings that they
exactly.
were hoping?
You keep adding those things that districts might do in the fifth day, and you pretty quickly erase the 1% or less of savings you started out with. The districts that have done the best with this have actually shifted responsibilities onto parents and nonprofits, some of them have done very well, getting the Boys and Girls Club or the church or whatever. And communities that I know you have a lot of them in Utah that are very well organized and have a strong church infrastructure and so on, they probably can get this done, although it's clear that it's a new burden on those independent organizations. Really remote communities that don't even have a church might not have anything more than a gas station, and some of the people live pretty far out and in separate places. That's a big challenge, and we haven't seen evidence that anybody's mastered that. And it's one reason we found that in Idaho, where we did most of our work, that some districts decided not to do it because they just weren't convinced they could do as good a job with a four-day week as they could with a five.
Professor Hill, what is the if a school district is going to go this route, hoping to get the most savings possible, but also do the least damage possible, given what little we know about the consequences, is there a responsible way to go about this, do you think?
We think there is. People who are listening and have interest in looking into this, the website of my center, it's crpe.org. And look up the fourth day week on that center. Georgia Hayward has written a couple of very good pieces on how to plan for the four-day week and how to evaluate how it's going. And I think those are resources that people should look to. Really, the big issue is to keep the kid question in the forefront and not the adult question. The adult question is, would teachers like a fifth day to be much more free and to take care of their own family matters and so on? The answer is yes. The real question is, can we adjust the way kids are educated and supported as to help the kids and not to decrease the quality of what they're getting? And I must say that if we look around at the districts that have gone to 4-day week, not very many of them are the ones considered the hot districts in their state. They're the ones that kids are already doing okay or worse and not going to college at the same rate as others. So there's a real concern that even if the results are not worse, they won't be good.
Yeah, but if you're in a situation like that where you're in one of those districts, I mean, your big problem is that you don't have enough money. And if your state
right.
isn't going to provide it, and if your local voters and your local board aren't going to provide it,
yep.
what do you do, right?
Yeah, some states have been trying to regulate against the 4-day week and slow it down. But it does, I think I agree with you that the one way to make it to slow down is to increase the funding into rural districts. But that's an outside of your pay grade and mine.
Yeah.
It's legislators. The big question I have is whether this will spread into urban areas. It has moved into the Denver metro, but still into a fringe district. Would it be something that what might happen in a central city district in Ogden or Provo or Salt Lake, or is it something that's always going to be either rural or fringe? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Paul Hill is founder of the Center on Reinventing Public Education. He's a professor at the University of Washington, Bothell. Thank you very much for your time today, Professor Hill.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll meet an investigator who specializes in catching tree poachers. Just ahead, why rehab and restoration on a scorched area after a wildfire is crucial to preventing new fires. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. It's great to have you along. The amount of money the federal government is spending to fight wildfires each year is roughly 7 times what it was 20 years ago. More than $3 billion is the typical annual price tag to beat back blazes on Forest Service and BLM land. As a result, there's been less and less money dedicated to other stuff, like rehabilitating the scorched land after the flames are out. But that has the perverse consequence of feeding the fire cycle. To talk this through, I'm joined by Pat Shea. He was director of the Bureau of Land Management in the late 90s. He is a research professor of biology at the University of Utah, and he's in studio. Thank you very much for coming by, Professor Shea.
Glad to be here, Julie. It's Pat.
So 20 years ago, that was just as the cost to fight wildfires were starting to balloon for the federal government, and you were there at the BLM. What were you thinking about at that point in terms of how do we get ahead of this?
We were concerned that the budget that Congress was appropriating wasn't going to keep up with the number of incidents of wildfires. So Mike Dombeck, who was head of the Forest Service and had preceded me at BLM as the acting director, we put out a campaign, quite frankly, with the congressional staff. We took them west to see some firefighting equipment and the cost and all of that. And so we literally doubled and then actually tripled the end of the budget for firefighting. And it was still consolidated in the Department of Agriculture, Department of Interior, with some input from EPA because of the air pollution problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we were worried that we were not going to have sufficient funds and often advocated for something like FEMA, where it's a rotating fund so that you don't have to go to Congress every time there's an emergency, which was finally adopted about 2 years ago.
Right, because it's only gotten worse since then. I mean, the fires just have gotten more and more, well, in some cases larger, but harder and harder, it seems like, to contain.
Well, part of that is the chicken has come home to roost, so to speak. For 50 years, the motto of the Forest Service and BLM was if the fire started at 10 o'clock in the morning, it should be out by 4. So we had this tradition of suppression. And what happened then is you kept building up the biomass. I was in the Bitterroot Mountains of Montana and saw places where there were literally 10 to 12 feet of combustible material that when it got burned,
this is like bushes, shrubs, sort of
leaves,
dried
branches,
stuff that just sort of the natural progress of a kind of
right. And we also have to remember
forest.
That at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, when people would go into the forest to get firewood for their furnaces and for their homes, that's gone away. So now we have this buildup as Mother Nature goes along, and we've disrupted the fire cycle. So then we have these huge catastrophic fires like we saw in California in 2018 and we're seeing now in Southern California. So part of the problem from my perspective, and when you had Professor Bruce Kane from Stanford on, it struck me that he was covering a very important part about wildland fires.
And we were speaking with him a few weeks ago about how California, how PG&E, the utility company there, like it was a high wind danger, fire danger situation in Northern California. So for like 3 or 4 days, power was cut out to hundreds of thousands of people as a way to like prevent a spark from igniting a fire.
Right. And again, we seem to go to drastic measures when a more rational approach would work much better.
Okay.
And that's why I sent you a note saying you really need to talk also about post-fire treatment, because right now it's bifurcated. You have rehab, which means that you have emergency service to go in and try to stop mudslides and the erosion that can occur if proper measures aren't taken.
Right.
But the more important part, as a biologist, I would say, is the restoration, to recreate a dynamic ecosystem that will sustain itself and not be put at risk by invasive species.
Let's break down, Pat Shea, the responsibility and the process here. So first of all, why is it even the federal government's responsibility to fight and then to rehabilitate land?
Well, the federal government owns, for instance, in Utah, 40% of Utah is federal land.
Okay.
Nevada, it's 93%. In California, it's smaller because they had an earlier start and they, quite frankly, privatized early on.
And this is land in the form of U.S. Forest Service.
National Forest, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, BLM, Bureau of Reclamation. Those are the five major land agencies.
Okay. And in the cases where – and a lot of that is undeveloped. It's either open for grazing or it's preserved for park use or for mining and that.
Well, BLM has the distinction of having multiple use, meaning you can have oil, gas, and mining. You can have recreation. You can have grazing.
Right.
You name it. It can be done on public lands.
And a lot of fires break out on these public lands?
Oh, yes. When you have that much acreage – lightning strikes, for instance, start many of the fires on public lands because they're not within the jurisdiction of a city or a county. And so then the federal government does have an obligation
To come in and fight the fire. The local folks, the state.
They coordinate, and that's another aspect of what Mike Dombeck and I tried to do 20 years ago, was to better coordinate the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, with local and state government firefighting capacity. So, for instance, Utah or California have their own statewide firefighting organization, and they coordinate with BLM or Forest Service. And yet we also one time I remember witnessing at the University of Utah a fire broke out on the ridge of Red Butte Canyon. The Salt Lake City Fire Department arrived. The county fire department arrived and the Forest Service arrived, and they spent 20 minutes discussing who was going to have jurisdiction.
Who's job?
Finally, a Forest Service fire boss stepped in and said, I have the money. It's my job, and everybody coordinated. So one of the things looking down the road is we need to have, especially with the internet and better communication, a systematic coordination of command at fire scenes.
Mm-hmm. When a fire has broken out, then it's all hands on deck, it sounds like, typically, hopefully, in terms of getting it put out. But one of the concerns you've raised is what happens when the fire's out, everyone breathes a sigh of relief, and then all the firefighters go home. And let's say this is land, nobody's living on it, we're not concerned about rebuilding, you know, houses or roads or anything. It's just sort of like open land that nobody's using. Like, what does it matter if we go back in there and spend money to do something on that land?
Well, let me just make one distinction, because Santa Rosa had a terrible fire in 2017 where 83 people were killed. Mm. Professor Kane and I are going to be teaching a class on wildland fires at Stanford, and we're taking our students to Santa Rosa. In the county, Napa County, there were 22 different fire districts. Now, if you're a small fire district and you've got equipment that costs $500,000 or $750,000, sometimes you're not really willing to deploy it for fear that it's going to get damaged or destroyed. So there is a lot of coordination that doesn't happen.
I see.
And then you get to having prescribed burns, and you have to go through an entire almost EIS process to start that prescribed burn.
Which is the idea of trying to get rid of some of this extra fuel, as you called it, that could facilitate a bigger fire.
And again, on the rehab side, the federal government will pay for that, but the restoration generally falls to the states and therefore doesn't get done very often.
All right. Three things you've mentioned here. First of all, there's the emergency response. So I have seen, like, you can Google or you'll hear people say, you know, after a massive wildfire, there will be some emergency mitigation that happens where they'll come in making sure that there aren't any mudslides, that things are, you know, sort of shored up and safe, right? Like, that happens. And then the next step is restoration. And then the next step after that is rehabilitation.
No, rehab is the first
step. Rehab first and then restoration.
Restoration is where you're trying to establish a self-sustaining ecosystem that has diversity of species, both grasses, bushes, and trees.
And that won't happen just naturally once nature has come through and wiped everything out with a fire?
Not necessarily. Now, in Yellowstone, with the fire there, it did occur rather naturally just because it's a pretty protected area.
Mm.
But for instance, in the Rocky Mountains, there is an invasive species called cheatgrass.
Mm-hmm.
It takes over. It
just outcompetes all the native grasses.
Yeah, it has a root system that is more or less horizontal, whereas native grasses and shrubs have a deep to absorb the water as it goes down.
Okay.
So the cheatgrass gets the water first, and therefore the natives can't compete.
Mm.
We had a 150,000-acre fire when I was BLM director, and one of the biologists for BLM went out and decided on his own to do an experiment. 50,000 acres, he was going to take a bulldozer and chain it and then drill seed native grasses. The other 50,000 acres, he had a plane fly over and do aerial seeding. And the last 50,000 acres, he did nothing. A year later, the one that he did nothing was 100% cheatgrass,
okay, which
is a highly combustible fuel.
Oh, that's important. So cheatgrass is far more likely to go up in flames.
Yes, and it has a much lower ignition point.
Okay.
The second area, the 50,000 that he aerial seeded, was about 20% native,
80%. He dropped native seeds down on this burned land.
Right, but again, it was outcompeted by cheatgrass.
Okay.
In the area that they chained and drilled was 95% native because they were able to establish a protection. But of course, what happened is we got sued by an environmental organization because we hadn't done an EIS before he did the chaining.
Oh, the environmental impact statement, get the official approvals to go in and disturb the land,
right,
basically.
So the left hand was stopping what the right hand wanted to do in the right sense.
Interesting, though. So the idea then to what is it? Restoration is the ultimate goal. That would be
restoration.
Like the post after 3 years is where really things are taking
place. Yeah. I mean, for instance, in northern Arizona, there was a fire in, I believe, the early 2000, and they went back in and planted Kentucky bluegrass because that was available. And within 3 years, they had another fire in the same area. Now, one of the things we also did, which has expanded, is we've created native seed banks throughout the West. So instead of going to Chicago and buying whatever seeds are available in August and September, there are these banks that contain large amounts of native seed, and they can go and plant those after the fire.
Hmm.
Now, what I'm hoping is with the military's expertise in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they've developed incredible sensing devices, you'd actually be able to do an inventory before a fire to see how healthy that ecosystem was, what were the native plants that were thriving there, what were the invasives that were there, so that when the fire came in and more or less, as you said, cleaned it out, they'd be able to plant quickly the native seeds and shrubs and trees that would then be able to be sustained in that area.
So literally trying to restore it to what it was like before the fire broke out.
Yes.
Okay. And if that doesn't happen, then especially in areas in the West where cheatgrass is common, this invasive species, that the cheatgrass is just going to be there in the soil. If there's no seeding or planting that takes place in that burned out area, it all just becomes cheatgrass.
The great story of that is in 1905, the Tooele County Commission in Utah.
Right, a rural area west of Salt Lake City.
To stop the cheatgrass that had fallen off a grain import from Egypt. Mm. But they didn't do it because it was going to cost $500, which in 1905 was a lot of money. Utah now has well over 400,000 acres of cheatgrass. Mm. So it is everywhere. And
there's no eradicating it, then. You just have to figure out how to let the native grasses that are more resistant to fire somehow take root.
Well, and the native fires have adapted to the kind – excuse me, the native sea – native grasses have mm-hmm. adapted to a cycle of fire. I mean, fire is part of the landscape.
Right.
That's something that Secretary Babbitt, when he was Secretary of Interior, was able to establish, that instead of this suppression regime – in some areas, as you were describing it, where people aren't living, that you let it burn, it actually improves the ecosystem. Hmm. If anybody has been to Yellowstone, it has a very vibrant ecosystem now. I was there shortly after the fire, and it was truly a scarred landscape that I didn't think would ever come back. And literally within 4 to 5 years, it was back and healthy and able to sustain itself without invasives coming in.
But Pache, if just fighting the fires to save the people in the houses is already a $3 billion+ federal expenditure, and it's another billion on the part of this state of California, or hundreds of millions in Utah or Montana or Wyoming, who's going to pay for the hand drilling of seeds in 150,000 acres?
It's not hand drilling. They have a caterpillar that has
it's a machine that goes through and
drills it.
Plant a seed. I mean, you basically have to farm the land to turn it back into – to try to restore the native species.
We're discovering what Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot knew at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, that Mother Nature is like a garden. If you don't take care of the garden, it's not going to be productive. It's not going to be sustainable. And this notion that somehow we just take our hands off of it. Now, we have designated wilderness areas, mm-hmm. and that's a whole different question than public lands that are being used for multiple purposes. So we need to have the metaphor, if you will, of a garden, and the garden needs to be pruned occasionally. And one of the ways it strikes me, and I've made this suggestion before, when I was BLM director, we introduced wild horses to state prisons so prisoners could train those horses and have some emotional connectivity. We also established prison firefighting crews who could go out and fight the fires.
Yeah.
Now, there's no reason in my mind with the technology we have to contain and monitor people that we couldn't take some of the minimum security prisoners and begin to deploy them to do the rehab and restoration after a fire has occurred. Or even more bold is to look at a civilian conservation corps where young people who sometimes are having a hard time getting a job would be able, through the national parks, the Forest Service, BLM, Fish and Wildlife, to go out and reclaim some of this land after it had been burned.
You said a moment ago that restoration often falls to the states, and the states are even more strapped because they can't deficit spend like the federal government. So states themselves haven't been able to figure out how to step in and restore their – you would think that they would have a real strong incentive to find that cash somehow to replant those native species.
You would think so, but my own somewhat cynical view is that the flames make the news. A growing bush or tree or grasses are not particularly newsworthy. And yet that's the very vital part to prevent serious forest fires in the future.
Do you actually believe, Pache, that if we were doing more rehabilitation and restoration of these burned out areas, that we would see fewer fires, or
we'd
just see them in different places and it would still be just as bad?
In smaller types. I flew into Portland, Oregon about 2 months ago, and the plane literally for 15 miles was flying over dead conifers because the pine beetle had gone in and destroyed them. So we need to be preemptive in stopping those areas that have been blighted from burning up in a catastrophic fire by going in and doing some logging that's done appropriately and planting new trees and new bushes so that we don't have that kind of tinderbox that's going on. You can fly over parts of Colorado, parts of Wyoming, parts of Utah, Nevada that have the same kind of problem.
Is it common, though, for a fire to break out in the same place a couple of years later that it just burned?
Well, the one in Arizona is a good example. You know, if the lightning is coming in, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's excluded. If there's not enough fuel, you're not going to have the catastrophic fires that you are having. If you've done the right kind of prescribed burn, if you put in the right kind of ecosystem, it's going to be more resilient against a fire.
Pat Shea is a Salt Lake City attorney. He's a research professor of biology at the University of Utah. And from 1997 to 1999, he was director of the Bureau of Land Management. Then he served for a couple of years as a deputy assistant to the Secretary of the Interior. Thank you for coming in today, Pat Shea.
Well, thank you, Julie. It was a pleasure.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, we'll meet an investigator who specializes in catching tree poachers in the Pacific Northwest. You're tuned to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Animal poaching is a problem you are probably familiar with. But did you know that people also poach trees? Timber thieves will take chainsaws onto Forest Service land and bring down a Douglas fir or a big leaf maple and then potentially make hundreds of dollars selling the wood to a sawmill or a furniture manufacturer. Ann Minden is one of a handful of people out there who track down tree robbers. She is a retired special agent from the U.S. Forest Service, and she now has her own investigation firm. It's called Minden & Associates, and she's with us now. Ann Minden, thanks for taking time today.
Good to be with you.
Seems like a pretty tough thing to get away with. So noisy, chainsaws, and yeah, I mean, it takes time to bring down a giant tree like this. How common is it that people get away with this?
It happens on a regular basis, unfortunately. It happens on national forest land. It happens on state lands, private timberlands, even somebody's backyard. If they have a nice big leaf maple tree, they could go away for a weekend and come home and find their tree gone.
Wow. Who's doing this? Who do these tree thieves tend to be?
Well, they tend to be fairly young individuals. I'm going to say 20 to 45 or 50 years old. And they often have a drug problem. They're people who don't have a regular job, and they are looking for some quick cash. And that's
cash?
Well, you know, it is because when I say quick, of course, it takes time to cut the tree down and to actually make it into a product that can be sold. But once it's sold, they're going to get paid for it. And then, you know, that's quick cash.
So how long would it take to cut a tree down of any size that would get you some quick cash?
Yeah, you know, they go out in the middle of the night and they scout these trees. They pick out the one they want and then come back and fell the tree. And that felling can take anywhere from just a couple minutes to much longer, depending upon the size of the tree. I had a case involving a 6-foot diameter, 300-year-old Douglas fir tree. So that tree didn't go down in a couple minutes.
Yeah, 6 feet. I mean, these people have to have some serious skill. You can't just go out there with a chainsaw for the first time and figure you're going to cut a tree down like this and not either harm yourself or cause a whole bunch of other damage and, you know, and like attract attention to yourself.
Right. It's very dangerous. And so if you're cutting a smaller tree, you have to have you don't have to have as much skill as if you're cutting a very large tree. But if you're cutting a very large tree, most of the people that would do that would be somebody who have had some serious experience felling trees for a living.
And what kind of preparation would they need to do of that wood in order to sell it in a way that would be profitable?
It depends on the species. So if you're talking about big leaf maple, for example, it's typically cut into some sort of round where they fell the tree, cut the tree into rounds, and then process those rounds into blocks. And depending upon what type of figure the tree has, if it's quilt maple, for example, and I can explain what that is.
Yeah, is this the kind of the pattern that you see in the round of the tree or in the cross section of the tree that makes it look like it's been, I don't know, designed in a really beautiful way? I can't even think of the word. Why don't you go ahead and pick up the thread there?
No. It's so there are two typical patterns. One figure, as it's called. One is quilt, and the other is flame. And you can see the pattern by if you remove a small piece of the bark. They can often determine whether or not the tree has figure. And so one of the things that these individuals do is, when they're scouting, is they go out in the woods with an axe and wander around looking for big leaf maple trees of a certain size and quality. And if they've been doing it for a while, they have an eye for it. And then they'll find a tree that looks like maybe one they might want to check. And so then they'll chop off a small piece of the bark and look for that figure underneath the bark. And if they find that, then that's a tree. They're going to come back to that tree. They may not do it at the moment that they are checking it, but they'll come back. They'll come back at night and take the tree.
So that would be the kind of thing where the wood is being purchased for something for its look specifically. Like they're going to sell that to someone who makes guitars or makes tables or something where you're going to see the grain of the wood because that's why it's so valuable.
Exactly. It's a really unusual figure, and it's highly sought after. It comes naturally, but you can't reproduce it. The tree has it or it doesn't.
And so the people who end up buying this poached wood, are they responsible, whether it's a sawmill or, I don't know, a guitar maker, are they responsible to get some sort of verification that what they're buying isn't poached?
Yes, they are. In fact, in the state of Washington, there is a specialized forest product law. And this law was originally created back in the 60s. It's been modified a number of times over the years. And I think it was 2005, they added big leaf maple to this law. Also, western red cedar, Sitka spruce. There's a number of other species that are included in this law, and it requires purchasers to record certain things. So, a permit number. They are required to say the type of product they're purchasing, the amount, the name of the driver, a license plate of the delivery vehicle, and a number of other things that they have to record when they're purchasing that wood. So there has to be a permit that is associated with that when they're selling it to these mills.
Well, if there's that kind of paper trail, including the name of the driver, and I assume they wouldn't have a permit if you're a poacher, or you would fake it somehow when you show up to one of these places. It seems like when do you get called in, and is that paperwork how you track down the bad guys who stole the tree?
Well, it's certainly one of the ways you track them down. It produces some really excellent leads. So you may find out about a case, somebody who's hunting, for example. I had a case back in 2012 when we finally finished it. There was a person who was hunting, and he wandered through this particular area in the Rocky Brook portion of the Olympic National Forest and saw a whole bunch of maple trees that had been felled. and thought maybe there had been a timber sale. There were so many trees that were down and with the wood removed. So he happened to mention it to somebody in one of the local bars who happened to then mention it to a Forest Service person, and it went from there. So we learned about it, and that's how that case started.
And then what would be your first step? They call you in as an investigator. You go to the scene of the crime. Is there, I mean, do you take footprints? Is there like DNA you can like extract from the tree and then like go out to all the sawmills and match it to something? Or
yeah, you know, you start, it's a crime scene like any other. And so there are some things that you do in the beginning. You pull maps and aerial photographs before you even go out there. You try to figure out what does the area look like? What other kind of harvest may have occurred in the area, if any? Are there property boundaries? So you get all of that kind of background information first. And then typically the first visit that when I was doing this for a living full time, the first visit is you do it covertly. So you may put on camouflage. You may just go during a time period when you believe somebody might not be there, but you definitely go in a covert manner and you make sure that your presence isn't known to anybody who comes back to the site. Mm-hmm. So you don't collect evidence.
Because they might still be planning to come back for another tree. Like you don't want to, you want to catch them red-handed if possible.
Exactly. So you want to look and see, is there more that they can take? Will they come back? Did they leave anything there that they're going to come back for? Because often they'll stash chainsaws in the woods, or you'll find stashed blocks where they've cut the tree, processed it into some type of a block, which is what they do with both maple and cedar. And they'll stash that, and you know they're coming back. So then you have to decide, when are they coming back? You know, that's really hard to know.
You try to just stake it out? I mean, have you ever caught anybody red-handed like that by waiting for them to show up?
I have not personally, but some of the cases that I worked where we had individuals that we put in various places out in the woods, we had a surveillance operation where we actually put people in the bushes near mills, put them out in the woods at road junctions, and put trackers on vehicles and tried to figure out where these people were doing it. And a couple of our people that were part of the operation did physically catch somebody in the process of stealing cedar. And it's difficult because it's very time consuming. And so you could sit for days and somebody may not come back. So in the case I was talking about earlier with the maple that was gone and the individual reported it, one of the things that we did is utilize another government agency that was doing overflights to try to find out whether or not there was any pieces of equipment that were at the site. So we didn't have to go there ourselves, but we could use somebody to fly over and look.
Is there any way if somebody to trace, like take a sample of, if you don't think they're coming back, if clearly this happened a while ago, is there any way to trace that tree to stuff that might be on the lot at a timber mill or a manufacturer in the area?
That is a big challenge. You have to have fairly certain idea that the wood that is sitting at that mill came from that site. There's you could definitely do that. The technology exists for big leaf maple in particular. There is a DNA database that does exist, and if you have suspected wood that you have seized, for example, and then you have a suspected theft site, you can test pieces of that wood and you can test the individual stumps and you can determine whether or not that wood came from one of those trees.
Mm. And how long could somebody, like, what's the consequence if you actually are caught having illegally logged?
Well, anything depends on the individual's their criminal history, on whether or not they cooperate, on a number of factors. But the people who are most culpable in these cases are usually the ones who are going to get the longest sentences. So you're talking somewhere between maybe 6 months in jail to 3 years in jail, sometimes quite a bit more. Mm. I think there was a case on the Olympic Peninsula, not involving National Forest land, but that I read about in the paper, actually, and it involved somebody who had been involved in stealing maple for a number of years, a name that I recognized as having been amongst those people that you talk about that do this. And he had been given 10-year sentence.
Wow. Ann Minden is a retired special agent at the U.S. Forest Service. She's a timber theft investigator. Thank you very much for taking time today.
Yeah, you bet.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. On Halloween, we've got a food scientist answering your questions about artificial colors and flavors, because let's face it, everything in your kid's trick-or-treat bag is loaded with the stuff. Some countries have banned artificial colors that are common in the U.S. What do you wonder about these extras that make our treats so tasty and colorful? Tell us what you want to know on social media. We're at BYU Top of Mind, or you can leave your question in a voicemail and we might play it on the air. That number is 855-242-8298, or you can send us an email, topofmind@byu.edu. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, an often overlooked reason America's schools are getting more racially segregated. Then, a book that provides a window into the lives of 15th century German nuns. And how a better system for diagnosing low back pain might help with the opioid problem in America. That's coming up on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. 65 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown v. Board of Education that public schools cannot be segregated by race. Court-ordered desegregation programs, such as mandatory busing, led schools across the country to be far more racially mixed over the next few decades. But beginning in the early 90s, public schools have been steadily resegregating by race. Some of that has to do with housing segregation. But school district secession is also part of it. There's a growing trend nationwide of splinter districts that are mostly white and wealthy breaking off from larger school districts. Erica Frankenberg researches school segregation and recently published some work on the effects of school district splits. She's a professor of education at Pennsylvania State University, and she joins me now. Professor Frankenberg, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Walk us through the chain of events. How does one of these school district splits or secessions typically happen?
Every state has law that governs the creation of school districts, including the ways in which communities can form new school districts. So as an example, Alabama is one of the most lenient states in the country in allowing secessions to occur. And as long as a community has 5,000 residents, they can move to form their own school district.
Okay. They don't have to be their own town, or it can just be any 5,000 residents who live.
As long as a municipality. That's an important clarification.
Okay. Okay. So it does have to be an incorporated city or town of some sort.
Yes.
But as long as it has 5,000 residents, it can create its own school district, just split off from. And typically, would the district, let's say in Alabama, would the district typically be including a lot of towns?
So historically, particularly in the South, but also in other regions of the country, the default district is a county. And so then the way it works in many places, an individual municipality can secede from the county, but there can't be, say, a school district that has three of these municipalities. So each one has to be separate rather than being a school district of three municipalities.
What are typically the arguments that a city would make that it wants to separate from its countywide school district?
We hear a couple of reasons fairly commonplace across the country. First is this idea of local control, which has long been something that's been used to talk about schools, that we believe that local communities are the best situated in order to make decisions about what students are being taught, how they're being taught it. There's also this issue around school financing. So because most school districts are funded by local taxes, namely oftentimes property taxes, the local revenue and the extent to which a local community is willing to tax itself or not for the schools affects the amount of resources districts have. And so in larger districts where there is either vast discrepancies in wealth based on the communities within that district Or if, for example, a school district has refused to tax itself to raise additional revenue, those can be some reasons in terms of having control over the taxing authority that some communities have also talked about wanting to form their own district.
Okay, well, how does this then become something about race? Because you've described, I think, arguments that maybe a lot of parents, if they haven't openly expressed it, have maybe felt it. Like, gosh, you know, I sure wish more money would go to my kid's school. I feel like this district is really big, and it's kind of too bad that there are these struggling schools on the other side of town, you know. But, man, I wish that my kid in my school could get more, right? I mean, that's sort of a natural human urge when it comes to your children. How do concerns about money and local control and wanting more say over your kids' schooling, how does that turn into something about race that drives segregation?
So these are actually some arguments that have long driven opposition to desegregation efforts. So when we saw, for example, some of the pushback to the Brown decision after 1954, some of it was about local control. We don't want these federal judges telling us what to do. It was local custom, for example, to have school segregation. Mm-hmm. So this is obviously a different era, but one point I want to make is that local control has long been a rationale used to justify existing policies that may either intentionally or unintentionally result in segregation by race or class. You know, today we're in an era in which most people are not going to advance arguments directly for reasons that would be considered to be racist.
Well, they can't. I mean, that's not, you can't create a school in America today, can you? Like a public school with public tax dollars where the explicit desire is to have more white kids and fewer kids of color.
So I think the question is, right, are we looking at schools that are created and do have different racial groups? Is that something that was intended or not? And that is the crux of the issue that a lot of the courts have adjudicated. Mm-hmm. There are two recent examples that are right on point. One is from California and one is from Alabama. So actually just last month, the Attorney General of California reached an agreement with the Sausalito School District, which is just north of San Francisco, and said that they were intentionally racially discriminating by allowing the formation of a charter school and then giving more resources to that charter school than the remaining school district school that was disproportionately educating more students of color. Mm. And so that was a finding of intentional discrimination. You know, they didn't say we're doing this because of who the students are, but the Attorney General thought there was enough evidence to charge them or to allege that they had been intentionally discriminating. The second example that I'd point to is a proposed secession by Gardendale, Alabama, which is in Jefferson County, Alabama, the county that includes Birmingham, the largest city in Alabama. Gardendale was trying to leave the larger Jefferson County School District, and Gardendale is approximately 90% white. Because Jefferson County was still under a court desegregation order, the plaintiffs went to court and said, this is going to harm the ability to fully desegregate the schools in this county. And so they had a trial, and ultimately the courts found that there was a racially discriminatory motive behind the Gardendale community's wanting to secede and leave the school district. Mm. So those are two recent examples in which they did find that there was some kind of motivation that was along racial lines that was affecting the segregation of schools.
Do we not ever see a majority Black or Hispanic community asking to secede from a larger school district?
Most of the examples that we've looked at, and we studied secession since 2000, the vast majority are disproportionately whiter than the county district they leave. So I said most, so of course there are some that aren't. Mm-hmm. But another point that I think is really worth considering is in some of my other work that has looked at school district secession over time, some of these municipal districts that secede and at one point in time are disproportionately whiter or disproportionately more affluent, as the populations in the metropolitan area transition, so more students of color and families of color spread out from the central city, some of these districts that have seceded go through rapid demographic secession because they're relatively small. Mm. And so some of them may start off as being disproportionately higher white, but they may end up having a disproportionately lower percentage of white students.
Hmm. Okay, so let's talk about consequences then when a secession like this happens. Because there have been dozens that have been allowed to go forward in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What
does the new district, which typically starts off being smaller and whiter and wealthier, does it – do the students do better? Like, does it turn out to be totally worth it to have fought this fight for those families?
You know, the extent to which evidence has looked at this, there are a few general things that I'll point to. One is that, you know, some districts have struggled to be able to raise the resources to which they had expected they would be able to. So there are a lot of projections, of course, that go into trying to evaluate whether this is financially feasible. After a district decides to secede, then there's a negotiation in terms of what kind of resources, in terms of the school building, pension liability, things like that, that communities have to negotiate. And in times that can be very fraught. There was just a recent one in Baldwin County, Alabama, with a seceding town, and there was some really serious back and forth that involved the state Department of Education to try to resolve it eventually. So a lot of things have to be resolved that may make some of the initial projections in terms of resources, they may not pan out in the long run. And then, of course, there's the transition. You know, any kind of upheaval can be a setback for children. And so the extent to which people have looked at, for example, accountability ratings, things like that. There's been sort of mixed findings, I think.
And what about the district that gets left behind, the bigger district?
Right. So I think that this is one that we don't always think about when we're having these secession discussions. So the district that's being left behind can have no input in many ways in terms of what's happening. They don't get to have a say in terms of whether a district's allowed to secede or not. And they still may be left with, you know, they may have some school buildings that they had helped to fund that are taken with them as part of the secession. So there's some pretty serious consequences, I think, just sort of financially. But I think also in terms of the extent to which we know that racial and economic segregation can be harmful for students who experience it. The extent to which they are left with more segregated schools as a result of the secession is, you know, just another thing for them to then try to address.
So the schools themselves in the district that was left behind become more segregated as a result of this of this one primarily white community leaving. So it wasn't
right.
It wasn't like it, because the other way it could have worked out would have been that there used to be a bunch of all white schools and, you know, mostly white schools and mostly black schools. And then the mostly white schools got together and decided they wanted to go be their own district. But the day to day experience of the kids left behind is the same. It's not like every white child from each of those different classrooms like up and went to this other district. Right.
Yeah.
Because it has to be, you know, we're still kind of a neighborhood school system in a lot of ways.
We are, but what I have found in looking at some of the school level changes in the districts that have seceded is that while they might have been located in a given municipality, they also drew in children from the county as well. And so those students now are having to be reassigned. They are typically now going to be on a bus ride for longer to go to a school because the one in the district that has now left, was actually closer to them, even though they didn't reside in that municipality. So in some places, actually, we're seeing some annexations happen because of concerns about this, which is then sort of a domino effect that, again, is taking away population from the district that already lost this municipality. And so continues to be sort of a longer-term effect. So I think...
But isn't this really, primarily, though, Erica Frankenberg, a housing segregation problem? It, you know, that if a district, if a city wasn't majority white, then it wouldn't drive more segregation when it left, right? But the problem is that we are more and more and have always been living in fairly segregated communities across the country.
We certainly do have high levels of residential segregation. And in part, I'm glad you brought this up, one of the justifications, too, for secession is by some of these local municipalities seeing the formation of a municipal school district as being something for community economic development, almost like another amenity, just the way a nice shopping mall would be or something like that. And so so I do think it's really important to think about this reciprocal effect. And certainly
it's like a feedback loop. Like the district becomes it's its own little small district. It goes to all this trouble, then it kind of sells itself as we have this great new district, just happens to be white, wink wink, and then you end up attracting more people moving in for that school district.
Exactly. So these political boundaries become social boundaries. And so that's why in our work we're trying to not just look at school segregation effects, but also housing segregation effects, because the composition of the school is a really important signal to potential home seekers in the community.
Do you think that school policy, though, like state laws around when a district can split, when a new district can secede and form, should that be the place that we're trying to create integration in our communities? Like, has it ever been a situation where our schools were the place where we were interacting with people of other races, whereas the rest of the world was pretty separated?
That historically has been what we've asked our schools to do. And, when you take a step back, you think that's a lot to ask of the public schools. But historically, that's the one institution in our society which most people have some interaction with, even with the rise of different types of private schools. For example, 90% of kids are still in the public schools. And so that is the place in which we have historically thought also, too, because of the important developmental experiences of interracial exposure at the youngest ages can have really important benefits. And that's another reason why not waiting until people are old enough to be adults and buying houses, but we need to start when they're 5 or 6 years old.
So the upshot here is that 65 years ago, Brown versus Board started this movement that allowed whole generations of young Americans to be exposed to and interact with and have friends of, in the classroom at least, of different races. But then as those court orders have fallen away, as we've sort of decided as a society that we've done enough on the school integration front, now sort of these natural forces of housing segregation have kind of reseparated us. And the school district secession thing is only just like fueling that fire at this point.
Right. And the creation of these school district boundary lines then are sort of putting almost boundaries around this residential segregation that exists.
Putting it more in stone, like more for like even like creating the segregation more formally.
Right, because we don't typically assign students across school district boundary lines, which is why this is so consequential for school segregation.
Erica Frankenberg is a professor of education and demography at Penn State. She studies school segregation and inequality. Thank you for taking time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Just ahead in about 20 minutes on Top of Mind, a better way to diagnose low back pain. And coming up next, the 500-year-old prayer book for nuns that a professor just happened to find languishing in a university library. C.R. Hewlett has that conversation.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. For years, no one knew the Dragon Prayer Book was gathering dust on a university library shelf. Not even the librarian had any idea the 500-year-old book was there. But then English professor Erica Beckler joined the Northeastern faculty and asked for all the ancient books they had. When the librarian handed her the medieval manuscript, she quickly got to work and discovered that it gives a look into the life of German nuns. Laura Packard is the lead student helping on this project and joins me on the line now. Welcome. I'm also joined by Professor Beckler. Thanks for your time.
Sorry, I answered for Laura.
No, you're fine. As long as you're there, Laura, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
So, Professor Beckler, why do you call it the Dragon Prayer Book? Did they worship dragons?
There's an adorable dragon on the first page of the book, right in the giant first initial letter.
Okay.
So we saw that. We couldn't resist it. That's what we decided would be our nickname for it.
What does that dragon look like?
It's got only two legs, and one is raised up, kind of like a flamingo. And two tongues coming out of its mouth, or a forked tongue that kind of swirls up in a little calligraphy, and a very long giraffe neck, and kind of a snout like a dog.
Mm. But we don't know what the dragon is for yet, is what I read so far.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, that's one of the many mysteries.
Huh. So could you describe what the book looks like for us, what the cover and the pages and everything looks like?
So I think the most remarkable thing when you first see it is how small it is. It fits easily into two open hands. Closed, it's about the size of a single hand, and it's pretty heavy. It's very thick. The cover is it's old. It's old leather, not always in the best of shape. And if you look very closely, you can see a stamping of a crucifix with a little snake winding up it. It's got clasps on it that have partially broken off. The outside also, the edges of the pages are black, which we think was probably at one time either silver or blue. If you open it up, it's a delight of colors and calligraphic swirls on many letters surrounding a very traditional-looking Gothic font. It's not really a font because this is before fonts were used in prayer books like this. And it's got little snippets of music all over it, too.
Oh, really? So you asked the librarian, give me all your old books. I'm a new faculty member here. And then when she handed it to you, what was your reaction?
Well, she said she came out carrying it kind of like a little baby. It's like, I have no idea what this is. It's been sitting on our shelves. And I opened it up. I took a look at it, and instantly my jaw dropped. I said, it's a medieval manuscript. And also kind of curiously, as I was paging through it, unfortunately, a little piece fell out. And it turns out that there was a loose leaf page that is probably a correction or an addition to some prayer within the manuscript that we haven't figured out yet.
Huh.
But it was very exciting. I'm like, what? Who knew this was here?
Yeah. And then you got to work and you brought on Laura Packard. So Laura, how old is this book?
Well, we've dated it to have being made after 1461. So it's over 500 years old.
How were you able to figure that out?
Well, there's a litany of saints, basically a list. And in that list, there are two St. Catherines, and one of them has a small marginal note next to her name that's Latin for of Siena. So with that, I went to Google, typed in Catherine of Siena, and found that she was canonized in 1461, which means that the book had to have been made after that year.
Oh, that makes sense. And what language is this book written in?
This is written in mostly Latin with kind of a smattering of German.
And we heard from Professor Beckler kind of what that text looked like, that curly and it looks kind of like this giant medieval font. And I was looking at some pictures. There's color in there, too, like red and different colors. How easy was this to translate?
Absolutely not easy at all. I think it probably took us 2 months before we were able to crack just the first couple of lines.
2 months just for the first couple of lines. Why? What was the main challenge there?
Well, there are a couple of challenges with this book. As you've noted, it's written in an older style of calligraphy. So the letters don't look like letters that we would write today. But the book is also very heavily abbreviated. So part of that challenge was deciphering what these letters were, because sometimes there was a P that had a curl off the side, and it wasn't a P at all. It was short for P-R-O.
Oh.
And that was one of the biggest challenges.
So you had to go through and figure out, basically, it's like a different language then if you have so many different abbreviations that you have to go through.
Yeah, each page was a massive puzzle.
Wow. And Professor Beckler, why did they use so many abbreviations?
Oh, the book is made out of animal skin, and animal skin is very expensive. So you have to kill animals in order to create this book. And if you're a medieval person who really relies on animal skin for coats, shoes, all kinds of other human uses, this is a pretty big sacrifice. So they want to save space.
What was the process for making the pages of this book? Was it time-intensive as well?
Very time-intensive. It involved raising the animals, of course, slaughtering them. There was a long process of drying out the skins and scraping the skins to prepare them, chemically preparing them, and then fitting them, shaping them into the page sizes. So I'm not sure how long exactly it would take to make a single single sheet, which then would be folded into the pages. But it was a very time intensive process.
And Laura Packard, when did you two have a breakthrough in translation?
I think that would have been the summer after I started working on this book. We were actually texting back and forth with our guesses for what this first page might be, the first couple of lines anyways. And once we made that big realization, once we started to see like what the first couple of words might have been, we put that into Google and we found a match. And that was hugely exciting, because once we had those first couple of words, we were able to get halfway down the page.
And when did you realize what this book was all about?
I would say from the start, we knew that it was a prayer book, and we knew that it was used by Dominicans, but we didn't know who the readers were. We didn't know that it was used by women. So it wasn't until we got much further into our transcription process that we found a prayer that mentions that it was used by women. It mentions the sisters directly, and that was a big breakthrough for us.
Professor Beckler, could you read for us a passage from this book?
Sure. I think if you don't mind, Laura and I would like to tag team on that.
Yeah.
She will read the Latin, and I'll translate it for you.
Okay, so great.
This is the prayer that mentions the women.
Sorores sobrie estote et vigilate, quia adversarius vester diabolus, tamquam leo rugens circuit querensquem devoret.
And that means, sisters, be sober and watch, for your adversary, the devil, goes about like a roaring lion, seeking someone he may devour.
Wow. That's so cool to hear the Latin. That was a great read. Professor Beckler, what does this book tell us then about the 15th century German nuns?
Well, we know that they prayed about every 3 hours. So they would carry this tiny little book on their person and pull it out to read the prayers and sing the prayers every 3 hours, probably together, very often together. We have located the likely origin for the manuscript in a convent just outside of German city Nuremberg, now southern Germany. And we know that this convent was a major convent in Dominican reforms, that the sisters were very literate in interesting ways. We don't often think of musical literacy as being a literacy, but they could read a very short notated music and figure out the rest of the song from just a few notes. And of course, they had Latin literacy and they had German literacy. German was their daily spoken language and the language of the convent.
Continue.
I'm happy to move to this.
You're fine. Yeah. How do you think that they would have used this book? Was it a book that they would have carried with them all the time throughout the day?
Exactly. We think that they probably, it's small enough to carry with you to put it in, to attach it to a belt on a girdle, and pull it out at all times of the day. If they're praying every 3 hours, it's helpful to have the book on hand. The prayers are all very well-known prayers, so they only needed just a couple lines of each prayer and, like I said, just a few notes of music to figure out the rest of the prayer. So it kind of acted like a prompt book.
And why is it significant that from this book we have a deeper understanding of these nuns?
Well, one reason it's significant is sort of the general, it's important for us to learn about our cultural heritage. But another reason is that we don't know that much about women, especially women in the 15th century who were most often not literate. So it's exciting to have this little peek into a group of intellectual women and understand their engagements with learning and spirituality of the time.
Laura Packard, how did this book that nuns used to carry around in the 15th century, how did it end up in the Northeastern Library?
Well, that's a very good question. We just don't know.
And no one noticed it before?
Well, it showed up in an article written in 1976 in a small black and white photograph, and it was valued at around $300, which is absolutely not its actual value.
How much is it worth?
We've never gotten it appraised, so we don't know.
It's way more than $300.
Okay. Yes. So is it a newspaper, you said?
Yes, it was in a newspaper article printed by the university. And that's really our only clue. With that, we know that the university had this book as far back as 1976, but before then, really, we have no idea. It's one of the biggest mysteries.
Yeah, such a mystery. But there are some events happening around campus now as a result of your project. Professor Beckler, could you tell us about a concert that's going to happen? How can you have a concert for a book?
We are very excited to team up with one of the musical a cappella groups on campus, the NU Madrigal Singers, who will be performing this music for the first time, and I want to say maybe the first time ever in the history of the book, because I don't think we can count the nuns' private daily practice as a kind of performance, maybe a spiritual performance. Laura's actually worked more on bringing the Chant the Dragon event to campus, and she can tell you a little bit more about the music in the book and how she's prepared for the concert.
Yeah, Laura, is there music in the book that they're taking this from, or have they composed it themselves and just taken the words from the book?
Yeah, there is music in this book. Many of these prayers actually would have been chanted, kind of sung. So we've taken the music that's in the book, which is written in modern notation, and which is actually kind of very different from the notation we know today, modern-day sheet music. This medieval music, it was very fluid, and you really could have a note be on any line. With music today, a sea is always in that same position. But with the medieval notation, they would move the clef around and give each line a new meaning.
Are these songs finished? You mentioned earlier that there may have just been like small notations.
That's right. They're really just kind of hints of music that would have clued the book's readers into which prayer they would be singing. They really only needed that much, actually. They were so familiar with these prayers.
I'm sure that concert will be really cool, and I'm so curious now as to how this ended up in the library, but I guess we'll never know. Thank you.
Well, never say never.
Never say never. Lauren Packard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Laura is a student at Northeastern University working on this project, and Erica Beckler is a English professor at Northeastern University as well. And thank you so much for your time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind, and how a better system for diagnosing low back pain might help with the opioid problem in America.
I'm Julie Rose. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind today. It's great to have you along. Back pain is among the top reasons people miss work or visit a doctor. More than half of regular opioid users report back pain. But opioids don't seem to work very well on back pain. And so addressing the opioid overuse problem in America requires finding better ways to diagnose and treat back pain. And to that end, the National Institutes of Health have awarded $2.5 million, approximately, a grant out of its Opioid Crisis Fund to help a team of BYU researchers with their work on low back pain. BYU Exercise Sciences Professor Ulrika Mitchell joins me in studio. She's on the team. Welcome, Professor Mitchell.
Thank you.
And Mechanical Engineering Professor Anton Bowden is with us. He's also on the team. Hi there. Thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here.
Professor Mitchell, what is so tricky about treating low back pain? So tricky that doctors will sometimes resort to prescribing opioids, even if opioids haven't really been proven to work that well.
So low back pain, especially chronic low back pain, is multifaceted. It consists of biosocial, psychological problems. So the biological problems are the ones that we are trying to address.
Okay.
The
Meaning what? What would be a biological problem?
A facet syndrome or a disc problem.
Okay.
Something
like
that's
a bulging
structural.
Disc or a slip, mm-hmm. I don't know, a slip disc, bulging disc. Those are the things
right.
That's like colloquialism for it, right? But all right. So actual, like there's something wrong in the spinal column.
Tangible, something you can pinpoint.
Okay.
Yes.
But there are other
yes,
things.
Yes, there are psychological problems and there are social problems, which we might or might not be able to address.
What do you mean social problems?
What support people get, or if they're working hard jobs that they can't really do well with their amount of strength they have, for example.
Okay. So it may not have become a physical, actual biological diagnosable problem,
exactly.
But there's repetitive strain because the job that they're doing.
Or dissatisfaction with the job could be a problem.
Being dissatisfied or having
right.
psychological stress can give you low back pain?
Absolutely, especially chronic. We're talking more about chronic pain here.
Huh.
What keeps the pain longer than 3 months, which we understand then, or we name it chronic low back pain.
Yeah, okay. And when someone comes in and says, "Doc, my low back, it's killing me," it could be a lot of different things causing that pain then physically. Like it's not just, oh, well, for sure you have X, Y, and Z, and this is how we treat that.
Exactly. That's the problem, to pinpoint the actual problem. And
the physical piece, because this is the specifically, like, who knows if it's a bulging disc or if it's some other thing, or maybe it's posture, right, that could be part of the problem.
Right. Yeah, could be.
Or degradation in the bones,
mm-hmm.
maybe.
All of the above.
Okay. And what is so hard about just putting that person in an X-ray or an MRI scanner and saying, oh, look, there it is. Here's your bulging disc. Let's go fix it.
So those are 2D pictures, and they don't represent at all the moving behavior of a person. People move differently when they have chronic low back pain because of the pain. And a picture can't really pinpoint it. Also, cartilage doesn't show up in an X-ray. The disc doesn't show up in an X-ray. You would have to take an MRI screen or mm-hmm. image to pinpoint those areas.
Okay, which oftentimes a spinal surgeon will do
right.
in
mm-hmm.
advance, take an mm-hmm. MRI.
However, sometimes you get a positive MRI or X-ray, and it has nothing to do with the pain the person experiences, or vice versa. You don't show something on an X-ray or an MRI, but the person still has a lot of pain.
Really? And in that case, there might be something biologically wrong, but it's just not showing up on those scans?
Correct.
Which you're trying to address.
We're trying to address more the movement behavior, that so the alteration of movements that people with low back pain exhibit.
What do you mean by that?
So if I have, for example, a problem with my right-sided spine, I try and stay away from it usually. So mm-hmm. I try and veer away. I sit on my, for example, left butt cheek more than on the right because that would put more pressure on the right side.
Uh-huh.
Or when I bend forward, I veer to the left again just to take the pressure off.
Mm-hmm.
So certain...
And that causes its own kinds of problems?
Yeah, that's right. It does, especially if you have it for a long period of time, months or years.
Okay, so a doctor might get an MRI and an X-ray of a patient who's experiencing that pain, and they won't know that the veering away or the favoring your left butt cheek is happening because they're not actually like there while you're in the. I mean, they could see you in the doctor's office.
Yeah, but oftentimes the doctors are pressed for time, so they send the person right away to get an X-ray or some kind of imaging procedure done. And they see the person sitting in the chair or maybe lying on the table, but they don't usually have time, or often they don't have time, and have the patient do some movement or look at their behavior.
And if they knew about the behavior and the movement, the solution that they offer might be different?
Potentially.
Yeah. Professor Bowden, come on into this conversation. So you're on the mechanical engineering side. What is this when she talks about you don't have a 3D image, you have a 2D image when you put someone into a CT scan? What can you expand on that from your perspective?
Sure. But I mean, we do get 3D images from CT. So, but generally doctors are looking at slices, and I think that's what Dr.
Okay.
Mitchell was talking about.
Okay.
But one of the key pieces that she's really brought up here is the fact that, you know, you've got surgeons that are dealing with patients that essentially they get data from a patient lying down where they hurt the very least, mm-hmm. right? So when we hurt because we're moving. And so they're trying to take that information that's from static poses, and they're trying to turn that into some kind of diagnosis, which is why low back pain outcomes are so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Really, out of all the things that we try to do to – you know, whether someone's got a knee that's hurting or a shoulder that's hurting or an ankle that's hurting or a hip that's hurting, we generally have fairly good outcomes. But when it comes to spine, the bulk of what surgeons look at is called non-specific low back pain, which means really they're not finding the mechanical source of what's going on. So that's what we're trying to do, is add in information for the doctor to give them objective movement information about how someone is mechanically moving, to understand this. We call it the mechanome, kind of like the genome, but how the mechanics of somebody moves.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanome of somebody's low back pain. And we feel like if we combine that with some machine learning about that, it basically says, if you move this way, you're most likely to have this kind of underlying problem. If you move this way, it's more likely to be this other kind of problem.
And that would offer additional clues for the surgeon.
That's right.
To say, okay, well, we couldn't quite see it on the scan, but from this data that we've got from the thing that Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Bowden have put together, it seems to me like your symptoms are pointing towards this. So here's some place we should pursue.
Yeah. And this collaboration is really enabled by three pieces. And, you know, our other collaborators aren't here, but David Fullwood is a material scientist. And,
okay.
And, you know, he and I have worked together for a long time on developing this really novel nanocomposite sensor that's very inexpensive, can be applied to the back. And so there's a material science component of this. There's a clinical component of this. And that's what Dr. Mitchell kind of brings to this, is just this experience with dealing with people who are moving poorly and trying to help them to, you know, to come to a better outcome.
Okay.
And then my side is kind of the biomechanics side of things, how the body moves and behaves from a mechanical engineering perspective. And so those three pieces together kind of form the team.
So the solution that you are working on that's been funded by the National Institutes of Health is trying to better pinpoint the cause of generalized low back pain. Is that correct?
Well, it's to try to move it from generalized low back pain to a specific diagnosis,
okay,
because then we can do something with it.
Right. And you mentioned nanocomposite.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
So what is the – first of all, just sort of let's zoom out. If you were to do this particular analysis on me, what would it entail?
So, you know, what our vision of is, and we call it the spine sense system. It's
spine sense. Okay.
But the idea is that we take some of these sensors we've invented, and they're, you know, we can screen print them onto all types of fabric. So essentially, we'll screen print them onto some athletic tape that we put a strip of this along your back. And as you moved around.
Screen print, which is like doing
a
poster
t-shirt.
Or a
yeah.
T-shirt.
Yeah.
So you just sort of like wipe it on almost like liquid paint or something.
That's exactly
onto
right.
Athletic tape.
That's right. And then we have some very thin wiring that connects those, and it connects to a microcontroller that talks to a nearby smartphone that records all the information coming off of these sensors.
And you would strap that onto my lower back or just like
yeah.
Tape it on.
We just tape that
slap
on,
it on there.
We just tape that on there, and then we give you a series of diagnostic tests, so some physical therapy type motions that kind of help us to know what's exactly going on.
Okay, then, so you might say lean to the left, lean to the right, lift your left leg,
yep.
Bend over halfway,
yes.
Kind of stuff. I don't
yeah.
Know what it is, right? But just
yeah.
Like, it's
do
not like you have to put
pokey.
Me on, all right, you don't have to put me on like a treadmill and make me run or anything
no.
Like that.
No, just
okay.
Move around normally. And then we probably also send you home with it because it'll
huh.
Stay on your back for several days and get an idea as to how you move during your normal activities of daily living.
Okay.
And then we feed all that into just a little computer algorithm that takes and then says, okay, based on the way you move, these are the most likely underlying mechanical dysfunctions.
Oh. Okay, now the algorithm, though, this smart software kind of problem-solving thing that's taking in all of these data points from these sensors, it's going to have to be trained
yes.
On people who have back pain that we can identify.
That's exactly right. And that's what we're doing over the first 2 years of this grant proposal is we're actually, you know, specifically making the exact device we're going to use. We're training the algorithm on a group of volunteers here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next 3 years of this are actually collaborating with other institutions across the U.S. as part of clinical trials at their institutions to kind of incorporate this into their different approaches to understand low back pain.
Professor Mitchell, do you envision that this would be done by a primary care doctor or by a spine doctor?
We're hoping to for this to be disseminated to physical therapists too.
Oh, okay.
Or chiropractors, anybody really who works with spines and chronic low back pain
okay.
Patients.
Would it require any special training, or it's just like, all right, let me unstrap this piece of tape that I just got out of the kit, the Spine Sense kit, and I'm going to slap it on your back and here we go.
Yep, pretty much. Eventually, that's what we're hoping
all right.
To do.
You'd have to figure out how to get it in just the right spot
right.
So
yes.
That you're reading the right. And there's no implantation, like no yeah. Needles going into my body.
No.
Okay.
And it's also very inexpensive. I mean, well, at least from a research perspective, these individual sensors are, you know, maybe 18 cents worth of material.
Yeah, it looks like you have a little bit of the
yeah.
Athletic tape right there that's
yeah,
got some of the sensors.
This is a small piece of stretchable fabric.
Okay. It's the fabric stretches, and that black strip in the middle, that's the sensor?
That's the sensor.
Those are the sensors.
And we can make it any shape, any size. We can make it any pattern. If you want to put
okay.
a logo on there, we could do that.
What is it sensing?
It's sensing strain, which means that the unique thing about this sensor is that as it starts in, you know, as we've screen printed it on, it has a very high electrical resistance. And then as it stretches, that electrical resistance drops dramatically, about six orders of magnitude. So it comes from something that is, you know, basically doesn't conduct electricity, an insulator.
Okay.
And now becomes something closer to a wire, depending on how far you stretch that. So when we connect that to a little circuit, then we can detect that change. And that's where that little microcontroller just says, oh, this one stretched this far. This one stretched this far.
Which is a sign of strain. So
that's
if I'm
right.
– so it's just mechanical though. Like
it's
so it's strapped
mechanical.
On my back and like all the way across like my low back and my across into my hips
yep.
area, like that
exactly
whole area.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that as I lean to the left or lean to the right or stand up or sit down, it's saying, oh, she's straining a lot on her right side or, oh, she's – you know, there's
yep.
no strain here. And all that's the data. It's just like
the
level of stretching of the athletic tape that's being measured.
Yep. So it's just measuring that stretch. Hmm. It's knowing where to put these sensors on the back and then being able to interpret that via this machine learning algorithm.
Right. To hopefully get a better treatment that wouldn't just entail, well, take these opioids and let's hope for the best. Or we'll do some surgery and see if that improves things.
That's exactly right.
Professor Mitchell, could this be used in a rehabilitation setting? So rather than having it for diagnosis, you know, I'm like, oh, my back is really sore. And so the physical therapist puts it on me. And then somehow it like beeps when I'm like standing or sitting in a way that's unnecessarily straining me, you know, like teaching me better
yep.
posture.
That is potential. That is something we were thinking about, to use it as a visual feedback with their iPhones or some haptic feedback with
yeah.
vibration, something like that, that the person might know that they're using wrong posture or they maybe should veer the other way or something like that.
Hmm.
That's all in the future. But it is something we've talked about.
Yeah.
So for the person, the patient, him or herself, be able to track their progress.
Yeah. Very cool work. Congratulations on the grant.
Thank you.
Anton Bowden is a professor of mechanical engineering. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Ulrika Mitchell is a professor of exercise sciences at BYU. Thank you
Thank
for your
you.
Time. This is Top of Mind. You can find us online at byuradio.org/topofmind. We are a production of BYU Radio. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.